Welcome to the Helping Families Be Happy podcast, where we explore the often messy world of family, love, and relationships. Now, I am your host for this podcast, Christopher Robbins, the co-founder of Familius, husband, father of nine, author, fly fisherman, and backpacker based in the beautiful Central Valley of California. And we hope to bring you nourishing, real-life information about love, family, relationships, and life. Now, I'm happy to introduce today's guest, Caroline Saunders. Now, Caroline is a Le Cordon Bleu trained freelance food writer and recipe developer working to bring the sweet side of climate cuisine to life. Her writing has appeared in outlets like Grist, 15C, and Smartmouth. She also writes the climate-friendly baking newsletter, Pale Blue Tart. Today, we're exploring how we can be better stewards of our planet and its resources. And to make it more interesting, we're exploring sustainability in the kitchen, the sustainability choices that start at the end of your fork. This podcast aligns with the Familius Habits, Learn Together and Eat Together. You can learn more about the Familius 10 Habits of Happy Families by going to the Habit Hub blog on Familius.com. For the video of this podcast, please go to the Familius YouTube channel. Now, Caroline, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, we're stoked to have you join us and to learn about how we can be better stewards of the planet through what's on the end of our fork. Let's start right there. So climate change is something that is that we seem to all be talking about. There's concern. We want to be good stewards of the planet. So how does food play a role in this, in our global climate?
So food plays a surprisingly giant role in the climate crisis, and that's both scary but also a huge opportunity. The food system drives about a third of global carbon emissions every single year, and that's just huge any way you slice it. A lot of that comes from livestock, red meat, but a lot of it comes from food waste. And something that I think is really exciting and empowering is that there are various organizations that rank sort of climate solutions. I think people hear a lot, and rightly so, about the importance of major legislative policy, but actually food waste and less red meat, more plants are right up there as two of some of the most important climate solutions out there. And those are things that, like you said, are right at the end of our fork. So it's something we can all take action on really well.
Okay. What we're just hearing is, you said a third is the result of our own global diet.
Exactly. Yeah. The food system all the way from the farm to the fork.
Now, if I might break in, if I remember it, were you part of the cookbook in support of the United Nations for sustainability for people on planet? Were you involved in that project?
So I was involved in writing about it, actually. So I was put in, I interviewed Erlene Cruz for a story that I wrote for the outlet Grist, a climate magazine, about the advent and proliferation of climate cookbooks, this new category of cookbook that I was seeing come onto the scene. And the UN cookbook was one of the first and most comprehensive and took a really cool global look at how diets could evolve to be a little bit more sustainable. And evolve is even not quite the right word, because it's more like just using recipes that already exist within lots of cuisines. So that's part of what's exciting, is that like none of this is actually really hard. We can all tap into more climate-friendly parts of our own diets and cultures that we already come from.
Well, we hope our listeners will, we encourage them to consider the cookbook in support of the United Nations for People and Planet. Wonderful recipes from cultures throughout the world using plant-based foods that really help. Now, let's start with, let's go to food waste. So there's so much waste today. What can we know about that and what can we do?
Totally. So I had the pleasure of talking to Erlene Cruz and learning a lot about the UN cookbook, along with some other climate cookbooks last year. And I was really persuaded by something that a few authors said to me, which is that food waste is this really amazing way into more sustainable eating that we all can implement, because it doesn't require us to buy anything different or eat any differently. It's just asking us to use what we have. So what's interesting about the challenge of food waste drives about 8% of global carbon emissions, What's interesting is that in Western countries, about 58% of that food waste happens in individual households. So what that means is that it's a problem that a lot of us have a ton of efficacy in being able to solve. So it's a pretty big opportunity that, again, like, all you have to do is figure out ways to use what's in your fridge and use what you bought versus buying anything different or changing your behavior.
So, okay. So I have a family. You know, sometimes food spoils. Maybe it was in the back of the refrigerator. We didn't get to it in time. But what is it that we're wasting? What can we identify that might resonate with us?
Yeah, for sure. So the biggest source is things that just go uneaten. So odds and ends of ingredients, like that half-eaten tub of sour cream that I had the best intention of using fully, but I only really had the one specific recipe in mind for, so it sort of just like languished. So odds and ends are a big thing. Scraps that we forget that we can actually get food out of because we're just not trained to think that way. So the leaves on cauliflower are perfectly stir-fryable. And so I like to think about a few strategies that I've learned from cookbooks over the past couple of years for spinning food waste on its head and like focusing on food use in my own kitchen. So I think about things like the first in, first out method that various restaurant chefs have advocated for doing in our own homes, having a little box or space in your like top refrigerator shelf, for instance, that you think of as your use me first space. Mm-hmm. So stuff that's about to turn. So that can be really useful. Befriending your freezer can actually be really great. So I think like the ice cube tray is sort of the undersung hero of food saving. So if you are making pesto and have extras, put it in that so it's a little bit more freezable. Freezing in both sizes and quantities and shapes that will be reasonable to defrost and use. I, as a baker, end up with a ton of leftover egg yolks and egg whites. And the single grossest food waste mistake that I make over and over again is adding more and more egg yolks into one giant deli quart container, which I will never be able to safely defrost. So I learned the hard way that freezing a couple servings of something at a time is better. And yeah, I've read some really cool tips about like the advantages of just like freezing in containers that will stack or in squares, things that make the entire freezer more navigable. And then the last thing I'll say that has been really helpful that I've learned from cookbooks is the idea of embracing riffable recipes that can vary a lot depending on what you have on hand. So there are actually two really cool cookbooks that came out last year. One is called Perfectly Good Food, and the other is called An Everlasting Meal. And they take slightly different approaches to the same concept, which is kind of like a Bible for how to use odds and ends ingredients. So there's a chapter on using up greens with extremely flexible hero recipes, or a whole section on shallots and how to use leftovers. So I think if anyone's interested in just sort of a starting point to how to waste less in their own homes, getting one of those two cookbooks can be a really great place to start.
Great recommendation. Now, from my point of view, what I really liked that you said was I can create a space in my refrigerator where I can put the leftovers that I know that those I need to get taken care of first. So right. That's great. And just in case you're wondering, if you have extra sour cream on Saturday morning, add, if you're making pancakes, 2 cups of flour, 2 cups of liquid. You know, I happen to use almond milk. Then you got your teaspoon of baking powder, a teaspoon baking soda, half a teaspoon salt. Okay. And then you got your 2 eggs. I like to use the full egg, not just the egg yolks or just the egg whites. So you have your own choice. Yeah. But then if you're going to, you have the sour cream, 1/4 cup of sour cream. So just take that extra sour cream that you left over, put it in there. Now you've got a wonderful pancake recipe.
Okay, noted. That's my weekend plan. Much appreciated.
There you go. Okay, now it's true, or I think it's true, that as more and more countries have developed a Western diet, they're consuming more and more meat.
Yeah, exactly.
And that has health implications, it has economic implications, it sounds like it has climate implications. So tell us about what we should think about in terms of reducing animal products and to help us. Maybe we really like?
I know, right? That's the challenge. So my vices, I will start by saying, what do you want to call them vices? Things I love are cheese and eggs. And I really like seafood here and there. And I also really love a good burger occasionally. But the reality is, we would all be a lot healthier and climate impact globally would be a lot lower if we all ate less animal products, full stop. So eating less is ideal. But within the sphere of animal products, there are a lot of gradations that can be helpful to know about so that you sort of know, like, what are good steps? What are the most impactful steps to take? Basically, red meat is many, many orders of magnitude worse for the climate than chicken, than eggs, than milk. And so even just like making some swaps when you're at the grocery store and shopping for the week and going for a container of chicken versus a thing of ground beef is like wildly meaningful. And so making small choices like that when you can are helpful. The ranking, as far as I remember the latest data of the worst climate offenders among animal products, it goes lamb, beef, then unfortunately for me, cheese. And so, yeah, eating more like white meat, getting protein from eggs, those are things I try to do. I also just like eat a pretty plant-forward diet, but when I want animal proteins, I try to stick with those slightly lower impact ones.
Okay. Well, you've kind of segued into healthy eating. So my wife sent me this article about how I could live longer and be healthier.
Right.
What I ate, and I started reading it and I sent her back this note. And I said, you know what? This article itself is above my pay grade. I can't even understand. So help us understand, if we want to change our diet, be a little bit healthier and be sustainable, what are some ways to start?
Yeah, totally. I have to mention, I don't know if any of you all listening will have seen this. I bet some of you have, this Netflix special called Blue Zones. There's this amazing National Geographic reporter who spent like a decade or more of his career, I think longer, going all over the world to find these little hotspots of food cultures where there were disproportionate numbers of centenarians, people who had lived to more than 100 years of age. And one of the things that those places had in common, there are a few, it's all really interesting, like tight social bonds, good diets. But one of the things they have in common is there's not much meat and there's a vast variety of plant-based ingredients. Some of them are heavy on beans. A place in Okinawa is heavy on a purple sweet potato. So what's cool is that people in these communities that are living super, super long are getting to those outcomes in ways that work for their culture and the ingredients that are around them. But they have some commonalities, and it's basically that they're plant forward and they hang out a lot. So like, that sounds great to me. I would like to live that way. And so, you know, again, I think trying to eat as many plants and plant-based proteins during the day as you can, as opposed to animal ones, like has a really clear correlation with health and longevity. And then there's an interesting thing that I always like to mention too about the health and sustainability benefits of eating a variety of ingredients. So biodiversity is in crisis the world over. Climate, biodiversity, these are two of like the big environmental crises of a handful, unfortunately. And I think people don't always realize, because I didn't until recently, that just by eating a wider variety of foods, you can not only improve our health, but also sort of vote with our fork for a food system that would be made from more foods rather than fewer. What's fascinating and horrifying to me is that more than half the calories people eat on Earth come from just three plants: wheat, maize, corn, and rice. And there are different numbers, but something like 70 or 80% of all the calories we eat come from like 15. So as our food system has industrialized over the past century, the food pyramid has been shrunk to this tiny, tiny pinprick. And that's both a culinary loss, a flavor loss, a health loss, and also a loss of environmental resilience, because agrobiodiversity is nature's insurance policy against change of all kinds. Climate, disease, pests, stuff like that. And so again, just by sort of leaning into like eating a weird grain here and there, or trying to eat a bunch of different green things that you can find, whether at the grocery store or a farmer's market, that adds up and is good for us and the planet.
I love what you said about the biodiversity, about it. All we have to do from what you just said is go back to the Irish potato famine and see when we, nature has a way, nature loves diversity. And we should too. And that goes in all areas of our life. We yeah. should love diversity. Now, okay, I happen to have a sweet tooth. I just got to have something a little sweet at maybe at the end of the day. Does dessert fit into this at all?
So totally. I really think that it does. When I looked around a few years ago when I was working at Grist Magazine and really monitoring what was happening in the food and climate world, I saw this really interesting thing happening where I saw more chefs, more food writers, more recipe developers focusing on this idea of climate cuisine, just sort of coming up with recipes that are sustainable and talking about what's on the dinner plate 50 years from now, 100 years from now. I didn't see anyone talking about dessert. And I don't know, for me, dessert is a huge part of my life. And I was just like, I just can't see the world getting interested in sustainable eating unless they know there's going to be really good cake involved. I had always been a longtime home baker. It's a huge part of my family's traditions. But I decided to go to pastry school and get more serious. And so now, a couple of years out from that, working as a recipe tester, developer, food writer, I decided to start a newsletter on climate-friendly dessert. Because I think what's cool is that there are recipes and blips of sustainable dessert everywhere already. And so what I'm interested in is sort of like collecting all those little bits and helping to assemble them into like a dessert menu for the climate era. So some of the things I think about are like plant-forward desserts. And that's a really interesting challenge in dessert because so much of Western baking relies on eggs and dairy very fundamentally. But there are exceptions to that, and there are other food cultures that use more plant-based ingredients. And then dessert, I think, is like the ultimate food waste solution. That's the hill I will die on because so many leftover ingredients can become dessert. If you have like fruit that's going a little bit dull and off, that can become granita, or it can go into a buckle or a snacking cake. I'm forever trying to collect on low waste recipes, things like that. And then again, variety is the other thing I think about a lot. How could we be tapping into more flavors, whether that's of interesting grains like kernza, that is a grain growing in the Midwest that has the potential to like wildly transform agriculture and yet also comes with this really strong butterscotchy flavor that makes it good for things like Pop-Tarts and coffee cakes, or embracing cool fruits that grow wild in America and could be part of a more resilient food system. So I think that there is a huge role that dessert can play in both becoming a little bit more sustainable, but also being so like tantalizing and delicious and easy that it in and of itself, my dream is, could help sort of inspire the rest of the transformation that needs to happen to our food systems. And my whole motto is like, start with dessert.
Well, it's a great vision and we want to help. Now, this has been not only fun, but it's been educational and inspiring. Where can our guests find you online, Caroline?
Oh, I love that. So would love to see you all on Substack. My Substack is called Pale Blue Tart, which is a little Carl Sagan joke for those that get it. I always explain it for those that don't. He called Little Bitty Earth a pale blue dot, and Pale Blue Tart calls dessert a solution we can all get behind.
Very clever. Well, as we conclude today's podcast, I'd like to thank Familias for their support in bringing this podcast to your ears and your heart. We'd be thrilled if you subscribed to the podcast and left us a review. And when you're ready for that next amazing book adventure, we'd be honored if you chose a book from Familias. One step at a time, one dessert or even tart at a time, we can make the world a happier place.